Tourism is vital to Hawaii Island's economy, and helicopter tour companies play a vital role. But as the helicopter tour business grows, the number of noise complaints, especially from homes along the flight path to Kilauea Volcano, increases. Some Big Island residents have formed an organization called Hawaii Island Coalition Malama Pono, or HICOP, to collect complaints about flyovers and noise, especially when choppers fly over residential areas. Troy Scott is a helicopter pilot and acquisition division chief for Paradise Helicopters on Hawaii Island. He's with us to address some of those complaints. Hi, Troy. Thanks for talking with us.
Hey, thank you very much for having me in the studio.
You were saying that in a way that the complaints that come your way are cyclical.
Yeah, I've experienced this. I started the industry a long time ago, about 1985, as a crew chief and used to work on helicopters and then started flying in 1991. And throughout that period, one thing that we've noticed at industry is you'll have groups of people that kind of move into Hawaii. They'll be here for a number of years. It'll become an issue with the noise, and we address it. And things are okay for a while, and then we'll get a new group which kind of comes in, and it kind of has to be readdressed. And that's one of the main reasons we reached out and wanted to be part of this, too, is to talk to some of the community and explain some of the things that we have done in the past and that we're doing now to help out with the noise.
Well, if you address the concerns of people 5-10 years ago, why would those concerns surface again?
In some cases, some people were not happy with the resolution. They still have a challenge with the noise the helicopters make. But in many cases, it's new residents or new arrivals to Hawaii Island, and something will happen or trigger, wait a minute, I heard a helicopter, and then I heard another one. And sometimes it's just an awareness that kind of grows. Maybe somebody flew over low like a rescue helicopter or the military. There's more than just tour helicopters out there, and they're not governed by the same requirements as us. And that might just bring it to the forefront, and then it becomes an issue for some people.
Let's play, if you don't mind, Troy, let me play an audio recording. This is Nicole on Hawaii Island.
My name is Nicole Albright. I'm calling from the Big Island of Hawaii, and I wanted to comment on all of the helicopter tour companies that are operating on the Big Island. And, yeah, it's a growing business. Unfortunately, the helicopters are flying over the east side of the island, sometimes every 1 and 2 minutes all day long. So, again, I think it would be really great if helicopters could fly offshore and then they could just fly way out over the ocean. The companies suggest that that's going to cost them more money, but, yeah, why don't they bear that burden? Why don't they bear that cost so that they can function here on the Big Island in a way that works for everybody?
Can you fly offshore, Troy?
Yes, in some situations we can fly offshore. So the HICOP organization brought up an idea, and they have aggressively sought local and state legislators and some our national caucus as well about this Long Island plan where helicopters fly offshore. There's a couple of problems with it. First off, in the FAA regulation which governs that, and the HICOP member who spoke to you talked about it, it says right in the regulation, this is very unique to Long Island, and it is because the helicopters used there predominantly are very high-end, expensive twin-engine helicopters, which no one currently in Hawaii operates. The difference could be, let's say, $1 million helicopter for a single engine to a $6.9 million helicopter for some of the ones they're flying off of Long Island. So our challenge is there is a cost, and as the caller mentions, you know, maybe the helicopter company should bear that. The problem is that will be passed on to the consumer. So right now, a lot of people, let's say in Hilo, who do that flight, they do it, they drive from Kona to Hilo because it's expensive to do these helicopter tours. They cost money to do. And if we were to pass that price on to do the additional route, just on the financial side, to fly from Hilo all the way out Kumukahi and then down to the volcano and back, it would almost double the length of the tour, which would almost double the price. Now, someone like me, I don't know if I could afford that. And so what we end up doing is pricing out a whole segment of people who would like to have the same opportunity as everybody to see the volcano from the air, and they can't because the cost has went too high. The other problem is, as you guys probably are aware, an helicopter does not glide as far as an airplane in the event of power loss. So if we're flying over the water, we have to have life vests, which we all have, and the aircraft has to have floats. And these floats will let us land safely in the water. We exit the helicopter, and then we're in the water. Now, anyone who's been on the eastern coast of any of our Hawaii Islands, especially the Big Island, knows that water is not necessarily so calm out there. So what happens when we have some passengers on a tour who are now in the ocean off the eastern tip of Hawaii? Where is rescue? rescues at Kalaeloa, or Old Barbers Point Naval Air Station, with the Coast Guard hours away. Mm-hmm. Hawaii County has a search and rescue helicopter, but that helicopter is not designed for overwater use as well. So we're putting those crew members at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And addressing the bigger problem is, as we fly to the volcano, many people will see us and they'll feel we're right overhead, when in fact we're offset quite a bit in many cases. So part of the HICOP's plan to fly offshore is a mile offshore. Well, all I'll really do is move the noise signature, noise pattern, to the coastline, Hawaiian Paradise Park, Makuu, Kalole, and flying just offshore, it'll feel like we're right there as well. So it doesn't really address it. The caller has a valid point. It's just the cost would be passed to the consumer, and it's illegal for us technically without floats and life preservers to fly where we cannot glide to land. And then even if we were able to, you're in a situation that if something bad did happen, what's the likelihood of rescue, or what would be the chances of losing somebody out there in the eastern side of the island?
Well, rightly or wrongly, Troy, a lot of the people who are in opposition to you don't care what it costs you.
I hear you.
And don't even care about, you know, safety concerns. Say, well, if it's not safe, don't do it. And the other thing the caller said was talking about a pretty heightened frequency of flights, overflights, you know, every couple of minutes. Mm-hmm. Is that a total exaggeration?
There are a lot of flights. One thing that we've heard pretty reoccurring is that it's gotten way worse. We did an analysis prior to coming here. In many cases, what we have figured is that the actual number of helicopters and the actual flights has not changed much since about 1985, and that's when we were looking at the different helicopter companies.
Mm-hmm.
For example, back then we had Hilo Bay Air, we had EO Helicopters, Papillon, Kona. They're all gone. Now we have Paradise, Sunshine, Blue. So the actual number has went up about 4 helicopters, the best of our ability to calculate the numbers of airframes. And as you know from back in the day when the volcano was going off, we flew constantly when it was 1,200 feet in the air. So the flight numbers has not dramatically increased. It has over time increased somewhat. And what Bob Ernst, during your last interview, and HICOP has done is they've used the Park Service's numbers. And they can be spurious in some respects, because sometimes when Pu'u'o'o is outside of the park, we don't go in the park. Therefore, we're not logging the numbers. So the numbers would have been lower a couple years ago when it was going towards Pahoa.
Mm-hmm.
And then as the lava flow moved back into the park, we have to log those overflights, and so the numbers will come up. So it's not a direct correlation. There are a lot of flights that fly over those communities between Hilo and the volcano. And so we've been addressing for quite some time, how do we mitigate that, or how do we work with the community and find a compromise that's safe and keeps a business that, speaking only for Paradise Helicopters, you know, is millions of dollars into our local economy. On the Big Island, we employ more than 100 families, and that doesn't include taxi drivers, fuel truck drivers, and all the community. So we like doing that tour, and people love it. And we feel that it's a good addition to our island economy. So that's kind of how we're trying to balance that. And how do we work with the community to mitigate the noise while still being able to do something we love to do?
Well, Troy, we've only got a couple minutes, but
yep.
Do you see resolution in the future? You say you're working with the community. The community, you know, you are working with the community.
Yeah. We have not stopped.
Is there hope for a resolution here? It seems awfully far apart.
I think that there is some things that we're going to do. And indicative of this is we have reformed an industry organization. It's the 501c3 called Hawaii Helicopter Association. It's just getting going right now. They've already invested tens of thousands of dollars for a new software program called Plane Noise. It's going to launch very soon. And what it does is allows people to either use an online form or call in, and it populates a geo-reference. So we'll be able to identify on a map where are some areas that are really a hot spot. And in some cases, can we adjust the flight path? Can we take different routes? And we, as an organization, can look at the complaint and the time. We can go into a system that tracks kind of where we are, and we can find out, hey, this pilot on this day was either following rules or maybe he wasn't, and we self-police the organizations. If someone's being a problem, you know, that's not good for anybody's interest. But we're trying to do that to make sure that we can work with the community. Here is a third-party vendor. You can get online or call in to populate a database so we can try to adjust routes. We still fly neighborly. Hawaii is the heaviest regulated altitude of any state in the union. So we are required to fly at certain altitudes. And as a pilot, I can tell you that when I fly over Mountain View and it's a clear day, I'm supposed to be about 3,200 feet is what equals 1,500 feet above the ground. I'm at 6,000 feet. I try to change that and try to get very high, and all of the aviators out there are trying to do that as well, varying our routes, taking different routes, and working to try to mitigate that noise.
Well, Troy, this issue isn't likely to go away tomorrow, so let me ask you to keep in touch with you about this, all right?
You bet. We're reaching out through you and our local legislators, county council members, and people like that, and making sure we educate them, and very shortly we'll provide to the community a website for the organization, Hawaii Helicopter Association, and the plane noise website and phone number, so we can try to work with the community, and at least they know that we hear them and we're trying to do our best to work with the community.
And we'll pass that information on through our website as well. Thanks a lot, Troy.
Thank you very much for having me.
Troy Scott is a helicopter pilot and the acquisition division chief for Paradise Helicopters on Hawaii Island. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, making sense of the Affordable Care Act and the proposed public option. But first, your quiz. In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about a woman who put women's athletics on the map in Hawaii and later served as the state's superintendent of education. She was born in Chicago in 1933, graduated from high school at 16, and excelled as a collegiate athlete. She moved to Hawaii in 1961 to start a women's track and field program at the University of Hawaii after earning a doctorate in physical education administration from Northern Colorado. There was no budget and little recognition for women's sports in those days, but she would change all that. She worked with U.S. Representative Patsy Mink on Title IX, the Women's Educational Equity Act, the law that broke open women's athletics in America. It required equal support for men and women in academics and athletics at any institution receiving federal money and was signed into law in 1972. They gave the UH women's volleyball team, the Rainbow Wahine, its name and hired Dave Shoji as its full-time coach. Today, we want to know her name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating more than 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on HPR.
Hawaii U.S. Senator Brian Schatz and U.S. Representative Ben Ray Lujan have introduced a bill in Congress to create a Medicaid-based public health care option, making each state's Medicaid program available to anyone who wants it. It's no secret that the current administration stands in opposition to the so-called public option, so we asked Tatine Santel, an associate professor in the Office of Public Health Studies at the University of Hawaii, to assess its chances.
I mean, it's hard to tell, you know, politically in Washington, you know, there's certainly been efforts that have been stopped to dismantle it in the legislative arena. But executively, you know, there's efforts to sort of undermine its core tenets in various ways with various efforts. And, you know, those can happen a little bit behind the scenes in a different way than you see in Congress. And so those efforts leave many people in many counties and many states in jeopardy in ways that can undermine people's access to insurance.
What are the core tenets of the Affordable Care Act?
Well, the core tenets are that the expand insurance options for more people to give them opportunities to get insurance,
right.
That people have certain mandated benefits that are part of the package that you have within insurance,
mm-hmm.
And that people are obliged to purchase insurance so that there is enough in the risk pool for people to be, you know, to make, because we have a private insurance industry in the United States, to make the private insurers willing to participate in that effort, you know, they want healthy people and sick people and well, right, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So the, you know, individual mandate obliges people to purchase insurance or pay a penalty.
Every description I've heard of the proposed changes to the Affordable Care Act give large numbers of people who would be kicked off health insurance. So why would anybody want to do that?
I mean, I think personally, it's a bit of a political game, right? I think Affordable Care Act wasn't the perfect solution to our healthcare crises, but it was efforts to improve our access to healthcare, to give people a core set of benefits, to
right.
make sure most Americans have some kind of access to health insurance access to healthcare via insurance.
Yeah.
I think it was a win for the Democrats, and I think there's been a lot of misunderstanding about what it actually entailed. And, you know, it was a relatively conservative option to maintain the system as we had it and build upon the private insurance industry, really, an employer-sponsored insurance, which a lot of people like.
A lot of the criticism, though, talks about people having their monthly increase greatly.
Right.
Has that happened for a lot of people?
So, insurance premiums have raised for some people. It really depends. You know, there's different mechanisms by which the insurance expansion has happened.
Right.
So that includes Medicaid expansion, which only some states did in the end. It was mandated federally. And then in the Supreme Court case, you may recall, one of the decisions when they decided to uphold the individual mandate saying people had to buy insurance, they said you do not have to, states don't have to expand Medicaid up to people with 138% of poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And so 32 states have expanded, including Hawaii,
mm-hmm.
But some states have not. So that left a gap for people who were relatively poor who then didn't have any subsidies to buy insurance. Then the Affordable Care Act had a piece where if you were above 138% of poverty, up to 400% of poverty, if you bought your insurance through these exchanges, the state-level exchanges, you would be able to have support to help you purchase those.
Financial support.
Yeah, financial support to help you buy that insurance. And then over 400% of poverty, you wouldn't have any support. And so some people fall in those gaps, right? They're either in states that didn't have that expansion.
Those 18 states. Yeah.
Or they're above 400% of poverty level and they don't have any supplemental, you know, funds to help them purchase that insurance. And for those people, and then it also depends on what states you are, what the offerings are, you know.
But they got hurt.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some people got hurt.
Mm-hmm. So some people are paying very high premiums. And in fact, of the approximately 10% of people that are still uninsured now, about 45% say that it's costs that's keeping them from purchasing insurance, many of whom are working adults.
What in an ideal world would you propose? Suddenly we're putting you in charge, Tiffany.
I mean, I wish we had a streamlined single-payer system of some type. But politically, it seems unlikely that we're going to get there dramatically. You know, we're not a country that makes such dramatic changes. There's a lot of stakeholders in the game. And I think building on our current system now as we try to plan for more optimal solutions
mm-hmm.
Makes sense. So I think, Schatz's proposal, as well as other incremental policies to, again, kind of build on what we have, make a lot of sense.
What is Senator Schatz's proposal?
So Schatz is proposing that in these state-level exchanges, one of the options people would be able to have to purchase health insurance would be to purchase Medicaid.
The public option.
The public option of Medicaid. Exactly. So there's two public options, you know, that you might be able to be insured now through the government. One is Medicare, which is for people 65 and older and with certain disabilities. And Medicaid, which is a means-tested program for people who are a certain income level. So you have certain means to be in the program.
Uh-huh.
As we talked about, it varies a lot by state. Medicare is consistent across the country. Medicaid varies by states. So there are certain mandates that are federal, but a lot of the variation is by states, including this expansion. And so that is the public option. Schatz has chosen to be his public expansion. Other people have indicated Medicare might be another option that allow people to buy into the Medicare plan.
Means-tested means based on your income.
Exactly. So what this would do is allow people who are above the income thresholds to be allowed to participate in Medicaid right now to still pay a premium and purchase that same, well, relatively the same insurance coverage.
Does that put the government in competition with private entities?
So it does, and Schott says he's agnostic to that outcome, that if, you know, the private companies can't compete with the public options, then maybe they're not competitive.
They're not going to be thrilled with that, are they?
They're not thrilled about it, but, you know, actually a lot of Medicaid is delivered through private providers, and so it may be, you know, a way, I mean, through private insurance companies, and so there may be some interest that they have in this option. Certainly right now they're not saying so, but mm-hmm. it may be more agreeable to them than they indicate right now.
What's your sense of the possibility that this could happen?
I mean, it's certainly not going to happen right now. I think support generally for Medicaid got stronger, actually, during these efforts to cut back on the Affordable Care Act. Mm-hmm. People became even more fond of Medicaid than they had been before. So about 65% of people are against cutting Medicaid right now. The expansion put more people, of course, within Medicaid. It goes up to pretty high levels of poverty in some states. It covers a lot of people in Hawaii and elsewhere. So people are very fond of Medicaid. I think people have also become interested a little bit more in the conversation around how do we expand health insurance for more people. Maybe we're not going to get rid of the Affordable Care Act. Maybe we need to figure out what to do about our healthcare system besides that question of, mm-hmm. you know, repeal, right? Let's have a more thoughtful conversation, perhaps across the aisle around what we should do. And so I think with that sort of political interest, the Democrats are trying to poise themselves as talking more about how we're going to fill up these, you know, gaps in coverage, how we're going to expand insurance to more people. So I don't think it's going to happen today, but I think over time, you know, there's a growing interest in expanding coverage, and certainly health insurance is critical to many people.
Sometimes in the court of public opinion, things have to get worse before they get better.
So perhaps the threat, you know, of the repeal made people realize what the Affordable Care Act was all around, you know, before. There were a lot of politics in the, you know, and melee around, you know, what it was and fear-mongering. And, you know, it was really an expansion of insurance, you know, relatively conservative, like I said. And to when it was threatened to be taken away, people realized, wait, I want this health insurance. You know, it's not, you know, taking away my guns and my country. Like, it's actually, you know, something I want. I want to go to the doctor. I want to be able to get, you know, access to health care for my children.
Do you think one of the things that's held this effort back is the sheer complexity?
Certainly, the sheer complexity is immense, right? There's so many details, so many, you know, policy questions, so many nitty-gritties and all the levels of detail. And I think it's hard to have conversations with anyone, so it's easy to have some overall picture of the thing. And, you know, when people hear the details of the Affordable Care Act, it's always been, even if they didn't like Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, they liked the details of what it was, you know, allowing people to stay on their coverage of their parents till they're 26, you know, making sure maternity coverage was, you know, part of the package, mm-hmm. mental health care being covered. They like those pieces. And so, but it's hard to have those conversations are not slogans, right? Those are real, you know, detailed conversations like we're having right now.
Are you optimistic?
I would like to be optimistic. I mean, I, you know, am in public health and believe, you know, access to health care is critical to making our population healthy. It's one of the things that makes us healthy. Certainly only one of the things, but mm-hmm. really important to people and their own security and their own family security. And, you know, I think as a country, it would be wonderful if we could move towards having more people have access to that. I think a stronger social security net generally would be wonderful.
Tateen Santel is an associate professor in the Office of Public Health Studies at the University of Hawaii. You can find a link to Senator Brian Schatz's proposal to expand the public health care option on today's conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha. I'm taiko artist Kenny Endo. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on the HPR mobile app. Find it in the Apple App Store or Google Play.
For generations, students with special needs has been segregated from the student population, placed in special ed classes. More and more educators these days are seeing the benefits of including so-called individualized education program students in the general population. But it's an area where Hawaii lags behind the rest of the nation. Reporter Suvan Lee covers education for Civil Beat, and she looks into the Hawaii classroom for today's reality check. Good morning, Suvan.
Good morning, Chris.
This is, you know, you can't really talk about special education in Hawaii without going back to the Felix Decree, right? Could you sort of set the stage with that?
Sure. You're referring to the Felix Consent Decree. This was a court oversight program that was implemented in Hawaii in 1993 based on a class action lawsuit that was filed by a disabled student in Maui, on Maui. And she alleged that Hawaii education officials weren't fulfilling the requirements under the federal IDEA law and Individuals with Disabilities in Education Act. And based on that lawsuit, there was a settlement reached in which this decree came about. And really what Hawaii was under at the time was court oversight to improve its special education services. So that ended in 2005. And of course, now here we are in 2017, and special education advocates say that there's still a lot to be improved in this area.
The criticism hasn't ever really gone away, but your story in today's Silbeat focuses on one sort of bright spot in this, yeah?
Absolutely. And that is an inclusion model known as co-teaching, which certainly is not new, neither nationally nor in Hawaii, but more and more classrooms are trying it out here.
And what's it consist of?
What it consists of is a special education teacher and a general education teacher, for instance, teaching a core content area such as math or social studies or science, co-teaching the class. So what you have here are general education students in one classroom in addition to special education students, those, by the way, who are able to be in an inclusion setting because, of course, you have varying levels of special needs kids, of course. But those who are able to sit in a general ed classroom are incorporated into the regular classroom. And the idea is that these kids are not treated separately or handled separately, but they're included. So the idea is that you can't tell who is who versus special education or general education. And what they're doing is learning in the same environment.
I would think that would have quite an effect, just a psychological effect, you know, just the whole idea of inclusion for somebody who's been told they're special and been kind of put in separate areas.
Sure. And the parents I've spoken with for this story have told me they definitely can tell the positive effects on their children. They go to school happier. They come back happier. Their self-esteem improves. It's great relationship building for these special ed students to be in the same classroom as their peers and not be treated or treated differently or in any special way. So yes, the parents and the teachers do notice a lot of positive impacts.
It'll be interesting to see if this is a trend that gets, you know, more widely adopted. Thanks very much, Suvan, for talking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Suvan Lee.
In honor of Veterans Day on November 11th, the U.S. Air Force Band of the Pacific offers a free concert in HPR's Atherton Studio. The talented airmen of the Small Kind Ensemble will be performing a mix of rock, pop, country, and local favorites. Admission is free, but reservations are suggested. Call 955-8821 during business hours or go to hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
2016 was a record-breaking year for national parks around the country. More people are visiting America's protected spaces, and with that increased human presence comes a cost. Secretary of the Interior Ryan Zinke, who oversees the National Park Service, has said the infrastructure of our national parks is aging and in need of renovation and restoration. To that end, the National Park Service has proposed a fee increase at certain highly popular parks to help fund maintenance. Volcanoes National Park on Hawaii Island is not one of those targeted for a fee increase, but it has been seeing record visitor numbers. Our producer Ryan Finnerty called Volcano National Park's public information officer, Jessica Farrakhan, to find out how that park has been managing the crowd.
Hawaii Volcanoes National Park definitely saw a record number of visitors in 2016. Our numbers went up quite a bit. Almost nearly 2 million visitors visited the park last year. And it looks like 2017 is going to be right on track for another big increase in visitation.
Why do you think we're seeing record visitation rates at national parks right now?
At Hawaii Volcanoes National Park, our visitation almost always parallels both the visitor industry. So if our economy is good here in Hawaii, we've been seeing, you know, peak numbers of visitors coming to the islands overall, increased spending, etc. But here at Hawaii Volcanoes, we've also noticed that when eruption increases or there's a big, really unique volcanic event like there was last year when Kilauea lava flows went into the ocean again for the first time in 3 years. Our visitation really parallels and mirrors that volcanic activity. So right now, we have Kilauea erupting in two locations. I think that's the only volcano on Earth that has dual locations for eruptions. So we have the Summit eruption, and we also have the East Rift Zone eruption, which are the flows that are going across the coastal plain and into the ocean. So both of those are eruption features are definitely attracting more people.
Yeah, I'm looking at your statistics, and it looks like since 2010, you had almost 500,000 more people in 2016. And since 1990, the better part of a million more visitors. How do you accommodate that many more people?
Yeah, our visitor numbers definitely have gone up. You know, our records show that since 2008, visitation has continued to climb every single year for Hawaii Volcanoes. And it's a real delicate balance on how we can manage the park and the increased visitation at the same time.
And I see here, too, that those numbers are only recreational visitors, and non-recreational visitors are counted separately. Are those scientists studying the volcano?
Non-recreational visitors would be, yes, scientists who are employed here by the USGS Hawaiian Volcano Observatory or University of Hawaii or other scientific branches working in the national park. It's also employees, concessions like the Volcano House Hotel, etc.
So what are the biggest challenges associated with high visitor rates?
We're having to address some really high-impact areas in the park. Our most visited location is the Summit eruption from Kilauea Volcano. Halema'uma'u Crater has a 10-acre lava lake, and every night that lava lake glows and puts on a really incredible night show, if you will, and everybody wants to see that. But we have to manage the parking in that area. So park rangers who normally would be doing law enforcement patrols or doing eruption crew duties or engaging visitors are having to deal with very crowded, congested parking lot situations now. And down at the Thurston Lava Tube, which is the second most popular destination in the park, it's the same thing. Parking is very crowded, especially on days like Tuesdays when we have a regular cruise ship surge that, of people that come in and tour buses. It's definitely a challenge.
Yeah, I'm seeing in July of this year, you had almost 15,000 vehicles on Chain of Craters Road. In July of 2010, it was just over 9,000. So, I mean, that's a pretty significant increase. What kinds of things are you able to do without significantly increasing infrastructure in the park?
Some of the tactics that we've been able to employ from a management standpoint, earlier this year we established a new viewing area at Jagger Museum. So there's the normal overlook that you can see offers incredible views of the lava lake, et cetera, right adjacent to Jagger Museum. But now to the right of that, we've created a new viewing area past the tour buses where people can go as an alternate location. It's actually a lot quieter than the Jagger Museum overlook too, so that it solved two problems of, having a really noisy kind of experience to now we have the secondary location where people can enjoy a little bit of a quieter lava viewing experience. Down at the Thurston Lava Tube, which is part of that chain of craters road increase that you've talked about, we've established 30-minute parking limits, so people can only park 30 minutes now at Thurston Lava Tube. They can't leave their car there and go hike Crater Rim Trail or Kilauea Iki Trail. They have to move their vehicle after 30 minutes so other people can enjoy that resource too. And in addition, a lot of people don't realize it, but sort of a ranger tip is this park is open 24 hours a day. And so our peak visitation, especially on a cruise ship day like Tuesdays or on the weekends or during the really busy holiday or summer months, is from 10 a.m. till about 7 or 8 at night. So people can avoid that. Local residents love knowing that and come into the park, you know, before sunrise. They can still see the lava lake glowing, or after 9 o'clock at night when they're guaranteed to get a parking spot.
Hawaii Volcanoes National Park is unique within the national park system in terms of biogeography. Are there concerns regarding endangered or endemic species with so many more people coming through the gate every year?
The primary species, native species, that is impacted by higher visitation and more traffic on the road is definitely going to be our nene, the Hawaiian goose, which is the world's rarest goose. And we have a resident population of nene in the park, about 250 of these gorgeous geese, and we're getting into the nesting and mating season right now, and so more traffic on the road means more pressure on the geese and species like that.
The National Park Service and the Secretary of the Interior, Ryan Zinke, are proposing some targeted fee increases in certain exceptionally popular parks. Volcanoes is not one of those, to help pay for some of the cost of these high visitation rates.
How do visitor fees factor into park maintenance?
The NPS began the fee program in the 90s, 97, and through the fee program, 80% of the money that we collect stays in the park. So some of the projects that get funded by people's entrance fees are meant to really improve their experience here in the park. So things like trail maintenance, striping of parking lots and roads to keep the driving experience safe, repair of cabins, the maps and brochures that you get when you come into the park, restroom improvements, picnic tables, all of that is paid for by your entrance fees.
So the bottom line is when you pay that fee at the gate, 80% of that money is staying within the park to help improve the experience for everyone who's visiting the park.
That's right. And the other 20% goes to help other parks that don't charge entrance fees. Like, for instance, in Hawaii, we have 9 national park units. A lot of people don't realize that. Only 3 of us charge entrance fees. Haleakala National Park on Maui is one of them, and Pu'uhonua Ohonaunau National Historical Park in South Kona is the other one. But there are these 6 other parks that don't charge entrance fees, like Pu'ukohola Heiau, and the 20% that we collect goes to help our sister parks here in Hawaii.
Jessica Farrakhan is the Public Affairs Officer for Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. You can find a link to the National Park Service's proposed fee increase on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hi, I'm Santiago Torres from Santa Barbara, California. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet and what we can look for in our dark island skies. As usual, we're turning to the expertise of Christopher Phillips. We've got him on the line. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have for us this week?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be here. This week, stargazers, look out for a planetary double act in the early morning sky. Venus and Mars can be seen rising in the eastern sky during dawn. Both are fairly bright and shouldn't be too hard to spot. The moon this week is full, meaning that stargazing for those faint objects in the night sky is going to be rather tricky.
And I understand this week we have a story that relates to a Maui telescope facility and a discovery of something from beyond our solar system.
Indeed. The mighty Pan-STARRS Observatory atop Haleakala may have made a historic discovery. If its observations are accurate, a team from Pan-STARRS and the Very Large Telescope in Chile may have discovered the first known interstellar comet traveling through our solar system. It is known as C2017U1, and its origin is unknown.
And this would be unusual because most of our comets come from the Oort cloud, right?
Right. We break comets up into two groups known as short-period comets and long-period comets, and they are all thought to originate from the Oort cloud. This new comet is on a highly eccentric trajectory that is very different from every other comet we know, which leads us to believe it came from outer space, quite literally.
And I imagine such a bold claim has to get backed up with more observations, right?
It certainly will. Right now, we need more data to confirm that this really is a celestial visitor from beyond the limits of the solar system. More observations from observatories will help confirm if this is in fact the case.
And Chris, how can a comet end up traveling through interstellar space?
Well, stars are on the move all the time. They orbit the galaxy, and as they do, they drag everything along with them. If they pass by one another, it's possible they can disturb each other's systems and potentially send stuff all over the place. It's possible that this exact thing happened to you once.
Well, we'll get updates here for sure. Christopher Phillips, thank you so much.
You're all welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week for Stargazer. We keep Stargazer on demand at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, designer of the Culinary Institute of the Pacific, committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design, providing research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
In today's backyard quiz, she was a pioneer in women's collegiate athletics, not only in Hawaii, but for the nation. In her capacity as the first women's athletic director at UH, she worked with Congresswoman Patsy Mink on Title IX legislation. That's the law that gave parity to women's sports teams. When she first came to Hawaii to start a track and field program for women at the state university, she had almost no budget to work with, but she was able, during her nine-year tenure, to create an enthusiastic statewide audience for her teams. One key volleyball match against UCLA in 1976 was the first time anyone had charged admission for a women's volleyball match. The result was a sold-out crowd and a come-from-behind victory. The Rainbow Wahine went on to become a national powerhouse, guided by the coach she hired, Dave Shoji. After leaving UH, she became the state's superintendent of education. Dr. Donis Thompson was inducted into the UH Sports Circle of Honor in 1988 and the Hawaii Sports Hall of Honor in 2007. A sculpture in her honor sits at the Stan Sheriff Center, and that's the name we were looking for today, Dr. Donis Thompson. Several people got that right, but Ruth Samuel of Kalihi was the first. So congratulations, Ruth, you're today's winner. And that's today's quiz. If you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. The link between dance and the sound of the drum is as old as humankind, but today's artists are finding new ways to renew an age-old partnership, combining genres of movement and dance from different and distant cultures. An upcoming show at UH Manoa combines a variety of traditional and contemporary dance styles with the sound and spectacle of the taiko drum. Betsy Fisher is the director and Kenny Endo the drum master, and both are with us in our studio. Good morning. Thanks both of you for coming.
Aloha.
Good morning.
Betsy, I'm seeing more and more mergers of art forms that didn't used to be merged, right? Taiko drum and contemporary dance used to exist in kind of separate silos, if you will.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, one thing interesting about this particular concert is I'm not sure it could happen many other places in the world.
Probably not.
Yeah.
Because we have access to Kenny, for one thing, right?
Yeah, he's definitely unique in the world.
What is it about that particular style of drumming that speaks to you as a choreographer?
Well, the soul of it, perhaps. Also, the action that the drummers take to make the sound, mm-hmm. to me, is an inspiration. The lines they create through their bodies when they strike the drums, and how that can be transferred onto the floor in full body.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because it's a visual. This isn't just a sonic phenomenon, right?
It's
visual.
Definitely, it's both. It's both. And there's its own drama involved.
Yeah.
Not narrative, but its own intensity that I really love.
Kenny, you've obviously studied this for a very long time. How important is the spectacle of taiko?
Well, traditionally, taiko is used as an accompaniment to dance and theater, to religious ceremonies, to festivals. And in the 1950s, a art form called kumidaiko, which is the drums themselves as a performance art. And since that has happened, people have become more aware of their stance and more aware of how they approach the drum. Mm-hmm. So a lot of taiko groups, it's definitely a visual spectacle to see, and as well as music.
Yeah. Well, it makes a very complete sort of performance experience. And for you, Betsy, as a choreographer, you have to think in terms of meter, right? When those beats are coming, how many beats happen, what the count is.
Absolutely. And that's true with any piece of music, but with taiko, because it's so strong, you know, mm-hmm. you have to groove with it. On the other hand, you have to meet it. You can't be subservient to it,
mm-hmm.
Choreographically or as a dancer. So you need to meet that strength and intensity choreographically and kinetically.
I like that. The idea of being subservient to the rhythm would just be being entirely literal. When a drum gets hit, a body moves.
Well,
you want to comment beyond that, don't you?
Yeah, it would be dancing to the music instead of with, mm-hmm. as an equal partner.
That's a good point, because successful choreography has a flow that doesn't just illustrate the beats you're hearing. It sort of illustrates, perhaps, and comments upon the beats.
It certainly can, yeah.
Is that kind of what you strive for?
And it, of course, it depends which piece, because you can address each piece uniquely.
Mm-hmm.
But I try to not to be under the thumb of the music, but meet the music as an equal partner in conversation.
Well, because as with anything else, you don't want the seams to show, right?
The seams?
You know, just in terms of making it too literal.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what we call Mickey Mousing, where you just, you know, the music goes fast, the dance goes fast, the music gets quiet, the dance gets quiet, you know. So you want to, sometimes you can do that, but sometimes you can work in counterpoint to that.
Yeah. Mickey Mousing, I've never heard. I love that term. I'm going to use that.
Yeah.
Kenny, we were talking earlier about the rhythms of taiko, you know, and here in the West we have waltz time, 3-4. Most, I'd say 90% of the songs we hear are in 4-4, 6-8. Beyond that, we rarely go. What are the rhythms that are dominant in taiko?
In Japan, traditionally, things are usually in 4 or in 8.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in no music, which is the no theater, it's based on a system called totan, which is 1 and 2 and 3 and 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. But for example, if I were to say tsuku tsu, tsuku tsu, 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 ten, ten. But the way they do it in no theater is that was played very metronomically, but I'm going to do it stretching and pulling the rhythm quick. So I'm going to play the exact same thing with the use of voice. Ho! Yo! Ho! Yo! So that was 8.
Wow.
But typically in a festival, for example, a piece called Mikoshi Bayashi, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So that would be a more of a straight
That was pretty close to a Western-sounding eighth-note rhythm, wasn't it?
Right.
For you as a choreographer, Betsy, I can really see where that would generate a number of options for you, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You were talking about one of the dances in this upcoming show where actually you have different dancers on the stage obeying different rhythmic counts. So some of the dancers were in a four and some were in a three.
Yeah, yeah. That's a piece choreographed by Yuki Shiroma, mm-hmm. Wonderful contemporary choreographer who's also deeply, deeply knowledgeable about classical Okinawan dance. And so she does an incredible job using some of those sensibilities and applying her contemporary dance skill to that. And in this section, Kenny, you want to play that rhythm?
Oh, sure.
And so she has her dancers, some different groups on stage, doing a stepping pattern. Some of the dancers in fours and some of the dancers in threes. So you see this visual manifestation of that three and four mm-hmm. that is embedded in the eight.
The great thing about having two different polyrhythms like that going at the same time is that they intersect at different points along the way. Right?
Yeah, they phase.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, thanks very much, both of you, for talking with us. It really sounds like a great show. Betsy Fisher is the director of Taiko Drum and Dance Hana Ho and the choreographer of some of the works in the program. She's the chair of the UH Manoa Department of Theater and Dance and a professor of dance there since 1994. Kenny Endo is a taiko drum master who was the first foreigner to be honored with a Natori, a stage name in Japanese classical drumming. The show will be performed the next two weekends at the Kennedy Theater main stage on the UH Manoa campus.
Turobane. You know that Sandy Tsukiyama knows her Brazilian music. On Saturday, November 4th, she shares with you an evening of well-known and lesser-known gems by Antonio Carlos Jobim. Purchase tickets to Just Jobim at hprtickets.org or by calling 955-8821 during business hours. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership, Wealth Management.
And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Up tomorrow, we're going to take a look at the national opioid crisis and its impact here in Hawaii. Tell us what you think about anything you heard on the program by calling our talkback line at 808-792-8217. We are from time to time asking listeners to call in during the program, but we'll let you know when that happens. The rest of the time, we do invite your comments at that number. I'm going to give it to you again, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. If you like any of the music you heard on the show, you can find the day's playlist on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook, and join us tomorrow.